our happy music. Good morning, Atlanta. I'm Dana Barrett. It is 9 a.m. on July 24th, and we have got a full house today, so I hope you're ready to dig in and do some talking. I'm feeling a little outnumbered. I'm the only woman in the room right now, but that's okay. Joining me today is a panel of guys that were all recognized at Atlanta's 101 Best and Brightest Companies to Work For, and which is a cool thing and also kind of one of my hot buttons, because there's so many bad practices out there right now in terms of, and I think it's maybe getting better as the economy is quote unquote getting better, and companies need people maybe more now than the people need the companies. So maybe the practices are starting to get a little better again, but these guys don't care about any of that because they're great places to work already. Around the room, I'm just going to go around and sort of introduce everybody. We've got Andrew Wells from Doherty Business Solutions. Say hello.
Hello.
All right. I'm going to make everyone say hello. Tim Gordon from Infomart.
Hello.
All right. And, you know, listeners, are you going to be able to distinguish all these voices once we get going? We'll see. Brent Collins, also from Doherty.
Hello.
Nathan Feather from Prime Revenue.
Hello.
And Rashid Brown from Career Ergonomics. Did I say that right?
Yes.
All right.
Hello.
Excellent. So before we get into the beef, you know, before we get into the meat of having good people, hiring good people, retaining good people, motivating good people, I want to go around the room a little bit and just talk about what your companies do and kind of what you do at your companies. So let's start with you, Andrew. Talk to me a little bit about Doherty.
Doherty Business Solutions is a management consulting company. We're in five different cities, a little over 600 consultants. We mostly focus on Fortune 500, Fortune 1000 companies, helping them solve problems from execution effectiveness, how do I get IT projects done better, helping them build analytic solutions, or sometime a custom solution, a portal, a website, or just helping them execute.
So you said how many cities?
We're in five cities.
And corporate is here?
Corporate's in St. Louis.
Okay.
We've got offices in Chicago, Atlanta, Dallas, and Minneapolis.
So that's a challenge, just sort of managing a workforce that's all over the country like that, I'm sure.
It is. We're mostly local-based, so our consultants do most of the work in the office that they're prime cities in, but we do travel a little, yes.
Okay. And what's your role in the company?
I manage the Atlanta branch.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. We'll come back to you.
Great.
Tim.
My name is Tim Gordon, and I'm the Director of Operations at Infomart. We do pre-employment screening.
Okay.
So when a company is looking to hire someone, they would send that person's information to us, and we would make sure that they did or didn't have a criminal background check. Their driver's license was clean. Their employment record, what they put on their resume was actually what they did. Where they said they went to school was actually where they went to school.
Oh, I have questions for you.
We do all of that stuff.
Interesting. I'm glad to have you in the room. Cool. All right, moving on. Brent.
Hi. I work with Andrew at the branch here in Atlanta. I'm a director. I have responsibility in the delivery space. So I have a number of accounts that I'm responsible for, the sales and execution within those accounts and the consultants that work there. And then from an operational perspective, I'm also responsible for our social committee, which includes our corporate citizenship committee and a number of other components that we help work with our consultants to make, Doherty be a great place to work.
Okay, interesting. So now you have the job sort of, it sounds like, of keeping some clients happy and some consultants happy.
And Andrew happy.
And Andrew.
That's a full-time job.
Everybody here has to keep Andrew happy.
Exactly.
And me. Everyone has to keep me happy, too, for the hour.
You're
anyway.
Learning very quickly.
After that, you're all, yeah, okay. All right, we got it. All right, very interesting. This is going to be a great discussion. I'm really, as you all introduce yourselves, I'm getting more and more fired up. Nathan, over to you. Talk to me a little bit about Prime Revenue.
Okay, thanks, Dana. Yeah, I'm the CFO at Prime Revenue, and we're the global leader in supply chain finance. So what that means is we help over 12,000 customers unlock working capital and cash that's tied up in the supply chain, that's tied up in accounts receivable and accounts payable. We have about 80 employees globally. We're in 8 countries, but Atlanta is our headquarters.
Okay, interesting. So you have a similar kind of situation in terms of people being all over the place and trying to keep that company spirit, the brand spirit, all that stuff across a bigger space geographically.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's our biggest focus.
Interesting. All right, we are going to come back to that. Rashid.
Greetings. How are you?
Greetings.
Well, I'm Rashid Brown, and I actually am the managing consultant for Kingdom Fortunes Development Group. What you have, Careergonomics, actually is our talent development guide that we've created, actually.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So, Kingdom Fortunes Development Group. So we actually are a federal government contracting company, and we support organizations in terms of business growth. So, and we also play a role in terms of talent development.
Okay.
So when organizations is looking to get the right people to be able to get the job done, that's where we come into play. We also play a role in developing internal talent.
Okay.
So when it's talking about having the right people in the right place, having the right folks with the right talent, how to be able to define that, that's where our organization comes into play.
Okay.
And so that's what Careergonomics is. We've produced that guide to be able to help companies and people understand what their talent is and how to best deploy it. So.
Interesting. All right. Now, I'm going to warn you guys before we dig into this conversation that I have decided in the last several months that it was time for me to catch up on all the business books that I missed over the last 10 years. So I have, like, right in the forefront of my brain, Good to Great by Jim Collins and Drive by Daniel Pink. I've just finished reading these books, so I'm, like, really into it right now. So I'm just warning you that if the soapbox comes out and I get on it, you'll have to roll with me and understand where I'm coming from. But I want to start kind of where an employee would start at the very beginning. You know, they're looking for a job and they encounter your company. What do you think companies sort of have to offer nowadays as kind of a baseline just to be attractive to the right people?
Good question. We sort of codify that along three dimensions at Darty. One is just the people you work with, having people that are good fits, team-based, collaborative, that you enjoy going out having a beer with after work. Second, what type of systems do you have in place to help them really move their career forward? From a performance management and career management standpoint, are you giving them the tools and support that they need to advance? And then lastly, what are you doing to help them connect with the broader group? And that could be helping them connect with corporate citizenship, so nonprofits or assisting their community, or creating some type of social environment that they're able to connect with other coworkers after work.
Interesting. So, of course, you didn't say anything about money, which we're going to get to. but I think that's interesting because basically what you're saying is, and I think this will ring true for anybody, that you're going to be in this place of business probably the majority of the hours of your life while you're here. And so it better be a place that you want to be, and it better be with people you want to be with every day.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting when you're the job seeker, I think, thinking that through, because sometimes you're looking at the package, you're looking at where is the office located, maybe how much money are they going to pay me? Do I like the title? Do I like my daily responsibilities? And you mm-hmm. don't really focus so much on the people. I can just, from personal experience, I can tell you that many years ago when I was in IT, I was looking to move. I'd been at the same company for 6 years and I was just ready to move on. And so I looked around and I found a job that was 2 miles from my house. And, you know, the products they were developing were kind of cool. Mm-hmm. And so I had a little voice in the back of my head that was saying, this is not a good fit. But I took the job anyway because the money was good and the location was good and all that stuff. And let me tell you something, day two at that company, I was like, I got to get out of here. These are not my people. This is not right. And they didn't do anything wrong technically, but I just knew. So I think it's really interesting, both as an employer and an employee, to try to listen to that little voice. You know, if somebody comes in the door, even if they have all the greatest qualifications, sometimes they may not be a personality fit. Have you guys experienced that? Anybody else in your hiring practices or on either side, I guess?
Absolutely. I think that when we go through our interview process, when we have someone that comes into the building and we want to speak with them, I always joke with them and they always laugh at us because our interview process, we speak as much as they speak. And for us, we want them to interview us and make sure that we're a good fit for them just as much as they would be for us, because personality wise, we have a very unique culture and it's one of the things we pride ourselves on.
Yeah.
And so if someone comes in and that culture is not something that meshes, it becomes uncomfortable very, very quickly. And you see a worse work product from those types of employees.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you're uncomfortable every day or you're feeling left out or it's just not the right space. Yeah, of course that's not going to be good. Do you have any thoughts on that, Rashid?
Well, yeah, I think that, our company, we actually perform group facilitations. So we're in the room with these job seekers.
Yeah.
And we're in the room coaching and training them to better understand what the employer is looking for. So with that being said, I think that employers, we have to do a better job in defining and also showcasing to job seekers really what we're looking for. I think that's a disconnect right now, is the fact that we have many people who come through the door, but they're very unclear about our organizational culture. We, you know, on the website, it looks great, but then when we get in the room to interview, it's something different.
Yeah.
So I'm speaking from the people standpoint here, not from the owner right now. I'm speaking from what we see each and every day, that I think that corporations, if we want great people, I think that we have to do a better job in describing that in the job description. Sometimes the job description is so Faulknerian that people don't really know what they're getting into. When you get there, the job description says one thing, and then when you interviewed, it's a whole nother topic and discussion. So I think that we as employers, we need to open up a little bit, and we need to be define that. Really.
You know, I'm going to bring this conversation over to you a little bit, Nathan, because as a financial guy, and you guys in the technology sector can appreciate this too, I think, you know, business executives have one personality, but sometimes programmers or financial people, they're more introverted. They're not necessarily going to walk into an interview and be, you know, your best friend and bubbly. Like, they're just going to maybe be a little bit more quiet, a little bit more introspective. And that doesn't mean that they won't fit in, but they may be sort of harder to figure that out in an interview process. Have you experienced that?
Yeah, that's a great observation. And, you know, for us, we're really trying to, in addition to all the qualifications for the job, make sure that it is a cultural fit. And we focus on that in the interview process. We want people who are smart, who are hungry, who are humble, who can come in and live our values. Because, as I mentioned earlier, we're spread across 8 different countries, and we need that core and that foundation that everybody can sort of work from and rally around. So, you know, that's almost more important than the qualifications for us, to feel like we're going to bring somebody in who can really be successful at Prime Revenue.
Interesting. Now, I want to come back to one of the other points you made, Andrew, about sort of giving people a way to connect kind of outside of themselves, whether it be to a nonprofit, to other people. You know, again, not money-based. This is, you know, but this is, I think, becoming more and more critical. I don't even remember what they call the new generation now. Does anybody know? It's like, I know we were X and Y and
millennials.
This and that. Millennials, thank you. My
I
brain.
Call them futurists.
I haven't had enough coffee this morning. So, okay, millennials. Even more important, I think, for the millennials than it was for us. None of us are millennials in this room, in case anyone is wondering. you know, I think this whole idea of giving back and, you know, mm-hmm. being a part of the bigger world is more and more and more important as the years go by. And a lot of companies seem to do this in a very superficial way, I think. Maybe saying, well, you have this many vacation days and you can have one day to go do a nonprofit activity. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of all they do. So how can a company sort of do more than that and actually sort of validate people for wanting to be a part of that and help them be a part of that and make it a part of their experience?
Great point. And I'm going to actually hand this over to Brent. He runs this for us. But I would probably say the general ethos that we go for is a sense of shared culpability. We want each of the individuals in our organization to feel like they own part of the company. So in that, we actually come up with several initiatives every year that everyone gets an opportunity to own. And in that sense of sort of shared responsibility comes a lot of great energy, as well as ideas for how they can make this workplace better, as well as contribute. But maybe Brent, do you want to take
sure.
this one?
It's especially important as consultants for the members of our team to remain connected to each other and to the corporate culture, because more often than not, we're working on site with our clients. And so it's very, by virtue of, you know, what we have to do, we oftentimes have to adopt our clients' culture to a certain extent to fit in and to be influential there. But we also have to maintain a sense of culture to our organization and a connection to our people. So because they're physically dispersed throughout the Atlanta community, as an example, we have created a committee structure that cuts across our operations. So an example of that is our social committee. Another is how we do recruiting. Another is performance management, knowledge management, delivery oversight. So these are all fundamental components to how we run a consulting business. And then we allow members of our team or offer the opportunity for them to volunteer to participate in these components of our business and running them, organizing them, participating in initiatives that set the direction for our organization to create that and foster that shared culpability. Mm-hmm. One of those components is our corporate citizenship committee. So we create multiple opportunities through several charities locally, the Atlanta Center for Self-Sufficiency and the Atlanta Children's Shelter. So we create a structure and create opportunities for people to participate and then encourage them to participate. And it happens sometimes on the weekend, sometimes during the work week. So I think the biggest thing is we're creating those opportunities for them, creating a structure for them to participate and asking them to get involved. And it's a way for them to stay connected to us as a company, to their peers at other accounts, and to the community at large in Atlanta.
Have any of the rest of you from seen kind of interesting new ways of kind of being a part of the community and the company at the same time?
Yeah, so a couple of years ago, we wanted to do more of these types of things. So we appointed a chief community officer in our Atlanta office, and she's done a great job of getting us involved with things like the Community Food Bank, Project Open Hand, the Atwood Community Gardens, and it's been really rewarding for our team to get out of the office together, to go volunteer somewhere, to build that camaraderie and that teamwork that can't really be established when you're sitting, in your desk as easily as it can when you're packing food in a box or, clearing weeds out of a garden or something like that. So,
and it's interesting too, because I think, on the earlier days when people would just give somebody, hey, you have 8 hours, go do something for a nonprofit if you want. When you go by yourself, it's not that it's not rewarding or not a good experience, but it's not nearly the same as being able to go with friends / colleagues. It's a way different experience, I think, in terms of your, I hate to say it because it's not all about enjoyment, but sort of your enjoyment of the day, your connection to the day, to the charity itself. Sometimes when you're by yourself, you just feel like they stick you in a corner to load boxes, and you sort of feel like, well, okay, I did something good, but I don't know how much I want to do that again.
I know doing it together with our team was fantastic, and we had some great pictures out of it. We had CEO and Hairnet and some other folks in Hairnet. So it's some things that are certainly circulating on our internal website there.
Interesting. And it is really rewarding. I think people feel really proud after a day like that, and of course, I don't know if people do this anymore, probably because budgets don't allow, but there used to be companies would go off on these big expensive sort of team building days where you pay consultants to, make you go on a ropes course or whatever, and catch each other in trust falls and nonsense like that. Now you're all looking at me like, oh, we do that. but it seems like going out to a nonprofit, it doesn't cost you anything, and except maybe transportation if you decide to provide transportation. And it's probably more rewarding and probably better for team building. So it's kind of an interesting shift and good for everyone, the charities and the companies.
And I think one of the best things about going on those charitable excursions, we do things where we've gone to Seven Bridges, which is a battered women's shelter, and we work with Must Ministries, and you get people that wouldn't normally work together necessarily in the company. You've got maybe the CFO and an entry-level analyst on the same line, serving turkey, the next serving a role, and you get a chance to connect with people in ways that you would never get to connect at a retreat, at the office, and you build relationships that you never would have expected to build that day when you started. And I think that's one of the better things from a business standpoint of doing that, beyond just the joy of being charitable and giving back.
Right. Right. It's a very, there's a lot of things going on that day.
Yeah.
Right. And if you're, a new employee, somebody fresh out of school or whatever, and you get a chance to stand on the line with the CFO, I mean, how cool is that? And chat about family or where you went to college or whatever. I mean, that's good stuff. You can't really manufacture that.
No.
All right, I want to go to resumes for a minute, because this is another hot button I have. And, when you're hiring, obviously the first interaction often, unless you've met at a networking event or something like that, the first interaction with somebody is their resume. And this is a sort of an antiquated tool, in my opinion, that hasn't really shifted with the times. And in fact, has gotten worse in a lot of ways because, and I don't know how much you guys use these things, but all these automated systems that exist online now, where your resume is screened out based on some keywords, I think we miss a lot of good people because their resumes aren't crafted properly or they have varied backgrounds or things like that. So how do you address the difficulty of weeding through thousands of resumes potentially with using the technology that sort of may rid you of some really good people?
That's a great question. And for the listeners out there that are wondering how important your resume is, it's, I would probably say the two most important items that you're going to have to attract an employer is going to be your LinkedIn profile and your resume. We probably use LinkedIn as our primary tool for searching for people. And then we also use some job boards as well as some databases. But your resume really is the picture of who you are, and making sure that just little things like your tailoring, you know, we all know you have a lot of really good experience. Tailor your resume for the job that you're going after. Two, make sure that you have someone proofread it. Little things like spelling mistakes and or poor grammar, that could really hurt you. And then, believe it or not, just the format. You get some resumes that look like they were just a blob of text put down, and there's not really a good format so people can easily read it. You are writing for your reader, and your reader is your next employer. Make sure that you're selling them on your primary assets that you feel will get you that job.
You know, it's so interesting listening to you talk because I think you're spot on certainly in terms of what's really out there and what people have to do. But I find it so unfortunate because, getting back to what I was saying earlier, you know, to Nathan about, you know, accountants maybe not being wanting to come in a room and be the life of the party. You know, also an accountant or a programmer or a graphic artist might not be a great writer, but that doesn't mean they're not a great accountant or a great graphic artist or a great programmer. You know, for a business consultant, it might be a little bit different because they have to be writing as part of their jobs. Mm-hmm. But there are a lot of jobs out there where crafting a beautiful document is not part of the job. And so exactly. If someone, you know, isn't crafting the perfect resume, that doesn't mean they wouldn't be the best freaking accountant on the planet, you know? Exactly. And so it's really, that's why I find it, I wish almost that there was like speed dating for employers.
There's actually several firms that a potential employee could leverage to help them craft their resume. So that should not be a stumbling block. For as little as a couple hundred dollars, you can get a professional person to help you write your resume and tailor it.
I know, we're going to debate this for a while.
I think that's the problem, and I think that's why there is a huge talent shortage right now. It's being talked about quite a bit. The companies are saying that they can't find the right people with the right stuff, and I think a part of that is our onboarding process, that they're antiquated, and we're not necessarily recruiting people in, but we're actually screening people out, and we're missing great talent, really, to tell you the truth. And so I think that that's one of the things that we need to address as companies in terms of what are we really looking for, and when it comes to screening and sourcing and attracting people, what's going to be the methods that we're going to use? And it just cannot simply be, you know, job filtering systems or a talent attraction system that is automatically automatically doing this work. There's no person on the back end,
right?
So it screens out 1,000, you may get 100, then you may get a person like myself who now takes a look at maybe 10 of those. But then there's a whole group of people that may not even have fallen into the platform because of an automated system that has certain cues and features and things like that. So I think that we have to do a better job in defining where we want to source it, where we want to attract talent from. And it just can't only just be an online portal.
Well, it's funny. It reminds me a little bit of online dating because, you know, there's a variety of different online dating sites out there. And, you know, there are some where you get to choose yourself by looking through a bunch of profiles. And again, you're judging a potential mate on whether or not they're a good writer, and maybe what their picture looks like, probably more than anything else, let's face it. But also, there are sites that pick for you. And I don't think those work. Because at the end of the day, you can't determine chemistry based on we both like this or we both don't like that, you know? And I think in a lot of ways, it's true for the job process, too. You talk about sort of that chemistry of that person coming into your office environment. and having to fit in. And you can't really tell that from a resume. No. They, again, might have the greatest skill sets in the world and maybe the perfectly crafted couple hundred dollar resume, but then they walk in the room and they're not a fit. So it's just, it's an interesting process. And I would love to see change. I would really love to see change over the next, you know, 5 to 7 years. I'd love to see companies finding ways to step outside the box on that process, because I do feel like, you know, you talked about, I know Andrew's like jumping at like really wants to talk and I'm not letting him. You know, you talk about sort of a need for talent and then, you know, companies saying they can't find the talent. And I think I picture it in a way as like two bubbles that are not connected. Exactly. There's a bubble. There is actually a lot of talented people either looking or maybe not looking, but willing to change if found. And then there's a lot of companies looking, but they're not finding each other because these systems are in the way.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, the process actually may be even more antiquated than that. You go back to the dating analogy, probably the best recruits we get are referrals.
Yes.
So I think your relationships and your network are probably more important than your resume.
Right.
Can everyone get better at how we source and how we connect? Absolutely. But when it comes to sort of the, if we only have so much time and we're having to go for high probability, the network is actually your strongest lever that someone can pull.
Well, I think that's a really good point. And I think, you know, for people that are out there, I had a friend just ask me to look at her resume. And she was trying to shift industries. That's a whole other question. Then if your experience isn't exactly related, then you get weeded out and all of those things. But, you know, I certainly have experienced in my own career that the best way to get any opportunity is by knowing somebody already, by creating relationships. And that requires you to get out there and network and go to events. And I mean, hopefully you're not going to events just to try to get a job. But you're actually going because you're interested in that event or whatever the case may be. But see, there again, that doesn't necessarily lend itself to every position. Not everybody. I mean, a lot of people hate those things and struggle and don't want to be there. And we had a scientist on. I mean, this woman was brilliant yesterday on one of the other stations. And she talked about going to networking events and how she would go. She can make herself go. And she goes and she talks for 2 hours. And then she's exhausted for 3 days because she's an introvert. She hates it. So she can do it, but it's super painful, you know? So if you have to make yourself do that every week, yikes. But you're right. If you can kind of get to know people and then maybe have your LinkedIn profile back up that you're legitimate and then have a company like Infomart back up that you're actually really, really legitimate, you know? But that's also another interesting point. Do people lie a lot on their resumes, do you find?
I don't know if they actually lie. I think that there are instances where what they remember is not exactly how it is. I think that memory is so nebulous at times that you may think, oh, I started in May of 2007 and you actually started in January 2007. And there are times when it's subtle like that and you think, oh, yeah, that's probably just misremembered. And then there are times where they said they worked there for 7 years and they were there for
two.
6.5 months. So I don't know that people lie intentionally, but there is a lot of misinformation, I think, that you can find.
I'm going to say something controversial now. I'm an advocate of lying. I believe in it. I think it gets you further. And what I mean by that is funny because we had last year sometime we had one of the top people at HLN on, and she's like the head of their digital whatever. And we said, well, how did you get the job? She was she used to be the managing editor of, I think, like one of the gossip magazines, like OK Magazine or something. And then she moved over to Turner, you know, to this serious CNN kind of world. And she had never really managed digital before. And they said, can you manage a digital publication? And she was like, oh yeah, I got that. No problem. I have tons of experience. She didn't have any experience. And she got the job and she did it and she made it work. But, and she basically said that was her theory was to go ahead and lie, you know, and that actually worked for me too, back in the day in IT. This is how old I am. My first technical job after sort of being in the non-technical side of IT, they said, do you know how to write a DOS batch file? Does anybody in this room even know what that is?
Oh, yeah.
And I said, oh, of course I do. I had no idea. And there wasn't even Google then, but I figured it out and I did the job, you know, and it was all good. And so anyway, the point of all that is that one of the things, and just before we leave the topic of resumes altogether, one of the things that I think is interesting is a job title, for example, in a specific industry might be meaningless if you're trying to change positions. So in my opinion, it's perfectly okay to change your job title to indicate what you were really doing. Now, that doesn't mean you say you were a vice president if you were, you know,
an analyst, yeah.
Correct.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, if you were, you know, if you were the head of, I don't know, some specific medical technology, and that's the title, I think it's perfectly okay to say, you know, product manager and not manager of, you know, heart valve something, you know. Mm-hmm. Do you all agree with that?
I do. I do. And the reason why I say that is because when you take a look at work groups and family groups, titles change according to industries. It changes according to different sectors where you are.
Sure.
So I think what people must do is understand about personal branding themselves, I think. I think what people need to know how to do is how to skillfully and masterfully sell their sets of skills. Because, see, their sets of skills are going to cut across multiple different type of industries, and it's not going to pigeonhole them. But if you're simply leading by your title or your tag, that's going to be a problem, because different industries is going to change your title.
Right.
I mean, it's going to happen. So we have to do a better job in teaching people on how to connect their talent and their skill and their treasure to different work groups, and I think that we'll have a better talent, and I think people will have a greater success in finding what they're looking for.
All right.
So I agree.
Here's a couple other things. Everybody asks this question. Does my resume have to be one page, or can it be two or three? Anybody? Thoughts?
It can be two or three is fine. Ten, maybe.
Ten is too much.
And, you know, when you talk about sort of how you're portraying yourself, how you're personally branding, I think there's sort of the title and the role. You know, the title may be you are manager, but your role, you could play a lot of different roles.
A lot of different roles.
And that's really what you want to get across. And over the course of your experience, you're going to have a lot of different things that you've done. And take out those components that you've done during that experience, put the right role type on it, and that's what you're projecting based off the type of company that you want to join and the type of position that you want to go after. And before we got on air, I remember that we talked a little bit about possibly hiring you. Now that I know that.
Now you're like, forget it. I love it. Okay, sorry. Anyway, and speaking of hiring me, no, I'm just kidding. Okay, so multiple pages we think is okay. What about old jobs? What about ageism? What about, because here's another thing. You get to be 20 years experienced, and that could be a positive or it could be a negative. Do you really care what I did 20 years ago in my first job out of college? Anybody?
If it's relevant, I do.
What if it's not?
I mean,
some people, this is why I'm getting at this. I feel like some people feel like they have to put everything they ever did mm-hmm. on their resume, whether it's relevant or not. Like from the minute they even, sometimes even prior to college. But mm-hmm. I think most people figure out that, okay, start with college and go from there. Is that really necessary?
I don't think you want to leave gaps in your resume.
Right.
I think as you get to what you've done most recently, you have a lot more detail around that. And that tails off as you get, you know, further down in your experience. But I don't think you want to leave, you know, significant gaps, because then people get suspicious and wonder what's going on or what happened in that period of time. So I don't think you have to have 10 bullet points on something you did 20 years ago unless they're very relevant to what you're applying for. But, you know, some of the best resumes I see give a lot of detail that are tailored, as Andrew said, to the opportunity you're pursuing for the stuff you've done more recently. And then the amount of detail gets less and less as you go farther back, but it's a complete picture.
Okay, but that's a really interesting point. And you just weeded out potentially a lot of really good people. And here's why. Because look at the economy we've just been in. How many people who are excellent people have been out of work and now have a quote-unquote gap on their resume? Well, what do they do about that? I mean, that's reality. That doesn't mean they aren't an incredible accountant, programmer, consultant, floor sweeper, whatever. It just means they were unfortunate, you know, enough to be in a bad economy and lost their job for 6 months or a year or two or three. So what do they do? How do you still look like a good employee if you had the misfortune of being out of work?
Well, I don't think – I mean, you can talk around those gaps. My point was just don't create one that doesn't need to be there, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. But I do think it's another fear that people have. It's interesting because even on LinkedIn, it sort of wants you to put all of your jobs in, and mm-hmm. it's the same kind of thing. Like, how much information do I really want to put in about a job that was completely irrelevant that I did – however many years ago? It's very interesting. There's a lot. I think I still think there's a lot of problems with the whole system. You know, you want to get to know somebody, but I don't know, that chronological order, date based paragraph about what you did. I don't know. I just feel like it's a very wishy-washy system. Anyway, let's move on and talk about money, because who doesn't love to talk about money in polite company? It's so funny. It's one of those things that we are so awkward about. I think we would rather talk about our colonoscopy than how much money we make. And so the salary negotiation is, I think, one of the most anxiety-ridden things for people. I mean, one of the most uncomfortable discussions. You go from when you're the job seeker, right? You think, okay, well, I know what I was making before, but I was underpaid, and I know what I'm worth. I want to make that. But if I say too much to my prospective employer, then I might price myself out of the job. If I say too little, I could be leaving money on the table. And it becomes this very anxiety-ridden discussion. And then companies, and you can all talk to this from the company perspective, I think also I feel like this process is fairly antiquated and can be, sorry guys, kind of manly in the sense that, do you guys ever watch the show Pawn Stars? Pawn Stars? Mm-hmm. And you know how the guys, you know, somebody comes in with their, you know, antique Elvis Presley blue velvet, whatever, and they say, I want $500 for this. And the Pawn Stars guy goes, I'm going to give you $200. And they negotiate back and forth. And at the end of the day, it's about winning. It's all about winning that negotiation. It has nothing to do with how anybody feels. It's about winning. And I think this happens a lot on the salary negotiation. So I come in and I say to you, I'm a consultant and I want to make $85,000. And you say, okay, well, we're going to offer you $80,000. And then you win. But not really, because now I take the job because I need a job. But I'm frustrated that you didn't give me that extra $5,000 that I said would have made me gloriously happy. So talk to me a little bit about your theory about what you should pay, how you should figure out what somebody's worth. I'm looking right at Andrew because he's got a smirk on his face like, she's crazy.
No, I think it's a really good point. And have you read Lean In?
Yes, I have.
Yeah, she talks a lot about how women underprice themselves.
Yes.
You know, I think most organizations, in particular, we have salary ranges, so bands by role. And that's sort of our guideline for how we look at our compensation. We actually compensate above market. So we
because you've read the books. I love it.
Well, one, we want people to be happy about their employment, about their total compensation package. And we sort of want to take off the table that conversation.
Absolutely.
We also want people, you know, it's pretty expensive to hire someone, to have a full-time recruiter go through the process, screen them, get them on board, and train them up. So are you going to let, you know, a couple thousand dollars stand in the way of you getting a good employee that you're going to be able to retain for an extended period of time? If you look at it from just a business valuation standpoint and the cost of retaining and attracting talent, a couple thousand dollars really doesn't make that big of a difference.
Right.
Now, with that said, it needs to fall in a particular salary band to make sure that they're compensated for their role.
Yeah, I think I'm so glad you said that. You're welcome to stay in the studio for as long as you like. No, I really, because I, you know, I said that I've been reading all these business books, and you know, that is one of the big theories is kind of get the money off the table, like pay enough, pay more. In fact, I think Daniel Pink in Drive says pay more than the average for that position or industry, because then it's off the table. The person's happy and they can be motivated by what actually motivates them to do their job and not by, you know, trying to get more money because they're desperate to get more money. And you know, he talks about the fact that money is not a motivator. But the lack of money can be a demotivator.
Absolutely. And I think there's another aspect to that as well is if you want the best talent, you're going to need to pay for it.
Right.
So if you want to build a strong organization that's fueled by your human capital, I don't think this is an area that you can skimp.
You know, it's so interesting too, because I should point out again, just for the listeners, that everybody here is here because they were part of Atlanta's 101 Best and Brightest, which means that you guys kind of get this already. So we're all preaching to ourselves and we all agree and we're all on the same page basically. But I think that's very true. And I think what that really means also, and not that you would ever market yourself this way, but if a company is looking for a consultant and they know that that's the philosophy of Doherty, then they know they're going to get the best consultant to come do their job. So, you know, that thousand extra dollars or two or three over the course of a 12-month period is not only keeping that employee being the best possible advocate for your brand, but it's also making your clients, it's marketing dollars in a weird way. You know,
absolutely.
you're informing your clients that we're bringing in the best people and we're willing to pay for that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So talk to me a little bit about some of the bad experiences you've seen around money. Let's go over to you, Rashid. Have you seen any crazy stuff happen around salaries, around negotiating?
Well, I can tell you what I hear quite often.
Okay.
Since we're in the business of workforce development, and what I hear from many job seekers is the fact that companies are not willing to pay value.
Yeah.
And I think that's going to be a disconnect in terms of you attracting the proper people, because at the end of the day, I believe that it's boiled down to how you value people. And if you pay people cheap, then you're probably going to get a cheap product.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, I mean, and they're not going to perform at the level that they need. And I'm sorry, money is a motivator. I'm sorry, it is. Money motivates people. People need money in order to do the things that they need to do. They need money in order to provide for their families. I think that's understandable. I think the question ought to be really is, as organizations, strategically, how do we view compensation in our organization? How does compensation align with our stakeholders and our strategic vision where we want to go? And if we understand that, then that then means then that attracting people and paying people appropriately, we have to discuss that and we need to evaluate that. And I think that for those who are listening who are out here looking for employment opportunities, I think that you must understand your value. We have wage reports that actually defines what people get paid. All of our organizations, if some, we participate actually in a wage summary that actually gives a breakdown, and it cascades to people what organizations pay based upon nonprofit, small, large, mid-size, and large. So I think that as career seekers, we have to become educated about our value and know how to negotiate that at the table when we get in front of folks like the people in the room.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because a lot of the questions you get when you're looking is, you know, when you're in that negotiation is, well, the first question is, what were you making before?
Right.
And I always want to say, none of your business. What do you care? That's not relevant. You brought me in, you like me for this job. What's it worth to you, you know, to have me on board? I feel like that's none of your, I mean, just like I wouldn't want to tell a new guy that I'm dating what I make, and I don't want to talk about it with my mom. Like, I don't want to talk about it. It makes me uncomfortable and it's none of your business. So just tell me what the job is freaking worth. You're killing me. But I also think it is interesting. I think we all on both sides of the table have to do our homework, right? You have to know what the job is worth as the person seeking the job and as the person offering the job. And you're right. I mean, if you're going to the person, especially as the economy starts to turn around and companies start to say things like, it's a tight labor market for technology and I can't find the people I need. They are going to be more selective. You know, if they know they're in demand, they're going to be like, you know what? If that salary isn't above average, I don't need it. I can find somebody else to hire me. One of the other things that I think is so interesting about all of this, and, you know, we've had the, I think it's FEI, financial something executives.
Right.
Yeah. On. And they've talked about the fact that like high CFOs and people like that, the turnover is super high for CFOs. And I think that's also probably more true in a down economy because everyone starts looking for somebody to blame. They're like, get that CFO out of here, you know? But I think, you know, so you have to be prepared to have those conversations on a regular basis, almost every 2 to 3 years, if you're in certain fields. That's just the way the world is now. So having a strategy about how to market yourself from a dollar standpoint, I think is hugely important. Have you seen much of that, Nathan, in your side of the world?
Well, there's certainly more turnover in the past 6 or 9 months than there had been for the previous 6 years, probably,
yeah,
or 3 years anyways. So we're seeing more of that, but it's also loosening up the potential new employees that we're bringing in. People are more willing to take a chance and make a change now, I think, than they were even a few months before. So
yeah,
there's certainly a lot going on in the job market that's changed. And, you know, compensation is a big issue. And, you know, you've mentioned it, but that's, I think, one of the benefits of being one of the companies that's recognized here as one of the best and brightest to work for is that by being a good place to work, you've hopefully built up some loyalty and some goodwill with folks, and they're not just going to jump to something else for a couple $1,000s,
right,
or something like that. And that's certainly what we've tried to do.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And sort of saying that that same idea that once the thoughts about money are off the table, a couple $1,000s isn't going to motivate you to move because you're happy where you are.
Right.
And I think it goes back a little to what we were talking about earlier about the culture and about even something like the charitable stuff that you do, really can build a total package. It is money, I think, is a motivating factor, but I think there's so much more that you can use to get people in and retain them once they're there, that if you're building a complete, almost like a life for the employee at the company, that you're doing more than maybe what $1,000 or $4,000 might do. One of the things that we do, I don't know how much my employees make when we keep that completely in human resources. And so when we're going through the interview process, it's a non-issue for us. We don't have to have that discussion. Our focus is on, are they going to fit? Are they good at what they do? And if it's somebody that's good at what they do, then we go to the human resources people and we say, this is the person that we want. And if there's a disconnect financially, they work that out. They figure that out at that level. And we're able to focus more on the performance and what we're going to get from them, rather than having money be the elephant in the room.
Very interesting. I think I want to move, because we're starting to, I knew we could talk for a long time on all this. I just knew it. But I want to move to retention a little bit before we wrap up the hour, because, you know, obviously getting people, the right people on the bus, as Jim Collins says in Good to Great, is key. But then you got to get them to want to stay on the bus, right? So retention is huge. And as you said, hiring people is expensive, and you don't want to have to keep doing that over and over again. You want to keep your turnover low, or back at zero if you can. And I think there's some obvious things, maybe not obvious to everyone, but probably to all of you guys because of why you're here. But I think the most important thing for people is to feel respected, heard. You know, so, and I want to talk to you, Brent, specifically about this, because you obviously have some specific connections to putting programs in place to sort of, you know, keep people bonded to the brand and to the, but there's also some just key things, I think, that kind of go with the culture of the company and how you train your managers who are dealing with people, that have to do with just sort of common courtesy almost, in a way. Do you find that to be the case?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it is about creating a personal connection with people and having them feel connected to the people that they work with and the organization, and helping create a sense of pride. And, you know, as you said earlier, everyone is most likely going to spend a majority of their waking hours with the people they work with in the job that they're doing. So they need to be proud of what they do. They need to want to talk about it. They need to want to spend the time with the people that they're working with and enjoy that. So creating opportunities for that connection are really important. And the other thing, obviously, is career growth, the opportunity to grow in what you do and feel like you're moving forward and that you're having new opportunities. So having a defined career development process is something that we focus on. We have mentors that are formal and informal that help guide your career and help you to move in the direction that you want to go, and help you think about where you want to go and where you want to be down the road. And, you know, those are all important to feeling like you matter, and that, you know, getting a personal connection with your leaders and having access to them. You know, sort of, we have a very much an open door policy. We try to have a lot of one-on-one connection with our people and encourage that, within our teams and across our accounts, because it is, a function of, like I said, creating personal connections and feeling like these are people I want to spend time with and I want to be with and spend, you know, even more time than I spend with my family with.
Yeah. I want to grab onto one thing you said, and I think you've mentioned it a couple of times now, both you and Andrew, about career development, because, you know, I think a lot of companies, when someone comes in, they sort of have to pretend they don't have any career aspirations, that they just want to be the, you know, whatever button pusher that you hired them to be for the rest of their lives, and they just couldn't be any more ecstatic to be there pushing that freaking button every day. But the reality is that that is not the case. You know, I want to say 99.999% of people out there working want more. They want to grow. And it's not always because they want more money, though that's sometimes a motivator, but often it's that they want the challenge. They want to learn more. They want to grow more. They want more responsibility. They want more respect, whatever the case may be. And so I think to acknowledge that everyone has those feelings, and to try to put in place something to help people feel like they are achieving that is huge. When a company's not, I mean, do you have any sort of advice for companies that kind of know they need to put something in place for that, but haven't yet?
Well, first of all, we definitely don't want people who only want to push the same button for, you know, their entire career.
Right.
You know, I just had a lunch with our new hires for this week yesterday, and that was one of the key messages that I talked to them about. The very first thing I want you to do this week is to create your career plan and tell me what do you want to do with your career over the next 6 months and over the next 5 years, because I want to help you get there. And that's one of the things that I'm passionate about, is helping people develop their careers. Because if you come in and you say, all I want to do is the same thing for the next 5 years, then I probably have made a bad decision on who I've hired, because I want you to learn and grow. And, you know, the people who hire us want people who are enthusiastic and who want to do more than just the bare minimum work. So we try to, you know, find people who are enthusiastic about growing their careers and who want to go somewhere with it, and encourage that. So for us, you know, we've put a career planning framework in place and assign, you know, career counselors formally to each person who comes into the organization, as well as peer advisors. So we have programs that connect people together. We have, you know, templates for people to create and to put their career plans together, you know, format, guidelines on how that should be done to create an opportunity for them to start to do that, and then connect them with the leaders in the organization or other people who might otherwise inspire them to grow into their career or grow in a specific direction in the career.
Interesting. Nathan, at Prime Revenue, do you guys have any sort of philosophy on career development?
So we don't have a formalized process like you described. We don't have the number of folks or the direct career paths laid out for everybody to be able to grow from staff to senior to manager to partner, or however they might grow. But what we try to do is encourage people to take ownership of professional development, to go take classes if they think that something that they need, to work with their manager to find out where they may have gaps or opportunities for improvement. And then also, if there's openings at the company that they're interested in, to apply, to internally apply for a new role if they're something that excites them and they want to try a different type of career path. We've had folks move from you know, all sorts of roles, from more analyst roles into product management roles and things like that over the past couple of years. So it's a little more flexible and not as well defined for us, but it's certainly something that's important. And like you said, if someone is not really interested in growing and developing, it may be not the right people.
That actually brings me to another point or question, actually. You know, you talk about people sort of applying for the next job on the rung, or, you know, and certainly if you're doing a career development plan, Brent, you know, the idea is that they want to move. So how do you manage somebody's enthusiasm that may be a little overzealous? Maybe somebody applies for an internal job and they don't get it because they're not quite ready yet, and the decision comes in to bring in someone from outside. I think things like that can often cause a lot of angst and sort of derail somebody in terms of being happy and satisfied. How do you deal with that?
I think it's about showing them how to get there. So, I mean, you know, it's great to be enthusiastic, but, you know, someone's not going to make the jump from an analyst to Andrew's job in a year, but you have to help them understand what the path is and, you know, what they would have to do to get there, and then help create those opportunities for them. So it's not good enough to just say, no, you're not there yet, but, you know, you need to create some hope and some opportunity for them and help show them a path to get there and let them know, you know, as concretely as possible what they would need to do. And let them know you'll support help them get there.
Yeah. Another sort of antiquated process in my mind. Of course, I don't have a big company that I'm running, so I don't have to – I can just say whatever I want, and you guys have to go out and execute it. But is the performance review. So, you know, I think I was listening to something about it the other day, talking about performance reviews. And typically, I think companies do them every 6 months, and managers hate them, employees hate them, everyone hates them. Do they really – benefit anyone? I mean, do they really get us to the next? Do they keep us happy? Do they keep us motivated? Do they keep us wanting to produce?
I think they do.
Do you?
I absolutely love the process, to tell you the truth, but I also think it's how companies engage that process, because when you talk about performance evaluation and really employee development, it has to be at the core of one's organization. And so what I mean by that is, what is our culture around developing talent and motivating and inspiring people? And what I say that is if we want people to be their very best, we have to help them to do that with inside of our organizations. And a part of that is understanding that the performance evaluation process, it's not punitive, but it is developmental. And I think that is the big difference, the fact that we use these processes in order to engage a person's performance. I'm being very correct because I really would tell you how I really feel, but to engage a employee's success. And the reality is that we had not sat them down, had the conversation about, hey, where do you want to be in the next year, the next 3 years, 5 years, and how can we as an organization help you to be able to do that? And so then your individual development plans become a product of that, and therefore you have people who are now engaged in the performance evaluation process. And unfortunately, many companies don't use the process like that. We come in, we give you, you know, your metrics and your KPIs, and we say, this is what you need to do. And then we show up 3 months down the road. We tell you, hey, you're doing great here. You're not so doing good right there. And these are the things you need to do. And then we show up 6 months. It's not really a process of development, of developing people, but it's more of,
All right,
yeah.
Here's the thing. I swear I should have you guys all back for another whole show because we're almost out of time. But this is, I want to equate the performance review to parenting. And I can see that Tim really wants to say something, so I'm going to let you in just a second. But first, I want to equate it to parenting. If you have children and you were to wait every 6 months to tell them what they're doing right and wrong,
something's not right.
It would not work.
Exactly. No.
6 months down the road, you go, remember back in September when you punched your sister in the face? Don't do that again. And the kid's like, what? I don't remember that. And the behavior's already set. I want instant response.
Exactly.
If I do something good, I want you to be like, hey, Dana, great freaking job. And if I do something bad, I want you to be like, can you come here? I want to talk to you for a second. You know, here's what you could do better. Right then. Right.
Exactly.
In the moment, because the problem for me is that 6 months later, I don't even know what you're talking about. I don't remember what I had for breakfast this morning, let alone what I did 6 months ago.
And I think it's a mistake to think of a performance review as only beneficial for the employee.
Exactly.
The performance review is beneficial for everyone in the company because, and first of all, nothing that you say in a performance review should surprise the person. Unless you're surprising them with a promotion because they've done something really, really well and they're excited to finally get that confirmation. But if you're telling someone this is something that you're doing incorrectly and this is the first they've ever heard of it, is that performance review that you do every July, you've failed as a manager. You're
exactly.
not getting the connection to your employees and your leadership team is not doing enough to get them going. On the flip side, to expect that the vice president of operations knows exactly what every person in the company is doing at all times is to, I think, give them too much credit. And a performance review works to kind of extol the benefits of what everybody is doing and say, this is the stuff that we've worked on. This is the stuff that we need to continue to work on. This is the plan that we have for you in the year moving forward. And so it's kind of, for me, a roadmap that you can use, but you have to make sure that you're following it throughout the entire year, but nothing should surprise you in a performance review.
I really wish we could have turn the mics off and just like brainstorm a better way. And then we could all be really rich and famous. Just saying. All right. Well, we're basically out of time. So before we wrap up totally, I want to just give you guys a chance to give your contact information for your companies. If anyone's looking for work or needs a consultant or any of your services. So let's start with you, Andrew, go ahead.
So absolutely. If you are in the technology field or interested in consulting, Darty Business Solutions, please look us up on the website and you can feel free to email me at andrew.wells@darty.com. And that's DAUGHERTY.
Tim?
Okay. We actually just released a brand new website within the last month.
Cool.
Completely redesigned. It's www.infomart-usa.com. You can follow us on Facebook or LinkedIn by searching for Infomart-USA, or you can email me at tim.gordon, G-O-R-D-O-N, at Infomart-USA.com.
Brent, I'm skipping you. No
That's
offense.
Fine. Okay.
So you can find us at www.primerevenue.com, or alternatively, you can just email me directly at nfether, that's F-E-A-T-H-E-R, at primerevenue.com.
Nathan, are you guys looking for anybody in particular at this
point? We're always looking for folks. We have actually a couple. I think we mentioned this before we started, a couple of development and IT roles that we're trying to hire. So anybody who's out there.
You guys are in competition.
Yeah.
Wow.
Awesome. Okay. And Rashid?
Yes. We actually can be reached very simple at kingdomfortunes.com.
Okay.
Kingdomfortunes.com. And yes, we dispatch consultants and contractors, actually, not only locally but regionally in the nation. So if you have a specific skill set in technology, instructional design, curricular development, if you are a person and you love to get in front of a group and lead people in group facilitation as a facilitator, we would be a great company for you. That's what we do. So, again, it's kingdomfortunes.com. Our number is 404-855-0739. Or you can email me, which is simple, Rashid, R-A-S-H-I-D, at kingdomfortunes.com.
Excellent. All right. Now I'm going to give my own personal plugs as well. I just launched my new Facebook page. I'm going to be redoing my website in a minute.
Cool.
I'll let everyone know when I do that. But in the meantime, if you want to go to my new Facebook page, get this. It's facebook.com/thedanabarrett. Dana,
nice.
Barrett. Dana Barrett was taken, so I had to come up with something. And on Twitter, it's Dana at Dana H. Barrett. This has been Good Morning Atlanta on BusinessRadioX.com. We hope you will stay tuned for more great programming, and we'll see you back here next week.